Session number 26947.
Mr. Jarvis, real nine. Now, what I want to do, and what we is quite important to us, actually, is to discuss your period as the docks manager of the West Indian Millwall Docks, which is a huge area of docks. Firstly, could you just describe what the West Indian Millwall Docks consisted of and where they were? What the sort of scope of the responsibility was?
Well, yes, the actual dock estate was roughly a mile square, and it comprised 35 ocean-going vessel berths. You could accommodate that number as a maximum. With regard to responsibility generally, I had 2,500 staff and labour I was responsible for. I had an annual budget of £20 million. In these days, that's not great, but in the 1970s, that was quite substantial. Mostly payroll costs that covered. And finally, where I had an estate responsibility of £65 million, comprising all the premises, cranes, and all equipment, etc.
Now, what was the importance of the West India and Millwall Docks at that time? I mean, to London, the Port of London, to the country. I mean, what?
Well, it was one of the five dock systems, the large dock systems in London, which had been developed since 1802 to cover the Empire traffic. Terribly important, and the Port itself was the largest enclosed groups of docks in the world up to shortly after the Second World War. But reverting to my own dock group, that was the very first one that was developed in 1802. And simple terms, it was developed because of security. There's so much cargo stolen on the river while vessels were being discharged and loaded there that action had to be taken. And the Prime Minister of the day, of Pitt the Younger, he decided that these enclosed docks would be built.
Yeah. When you say enclosed docks, you just explain what you mean.
Well, enclosed docks is where docks, ships have to come into lock entrances, and then regardless of the height of the river, which obviously the Thames is tidal, and once they're in there, the locks of water, they're raised in the locks with the water being pumped in. And water is impounded into the docks by separate systems and kept at a constant level, so ships actually can remain buoyant during the course of their discharging and loading. Now, those enclosed docks simply refer to areas of impounded water.
And was the role of your docks as big in 1973 as it had been previously? I mean, were the docks, was there any sense of the docks being in decline at that time?
Oh yes, yes. The London St Catherine docks had been closed because they were a much smaller group of docks and could only take limited size vessels, and then. In the early part of the 70s, the Surrey Commercial Docks, which is the only group south of the river, they in turn were closed. But when it came to the 70s, the dock group I was responsible for was working virtually to its maximum, but it was appreciated that with the advent of mechanisation and containerisation, the change in technology would eventually influence the vessels coming into that dock and to the other docks that were still remaining. Now, with regard to the closure of the Indian Millwall Docks, as obviously came about, it really was brought about not by...
I'll come to that, because that's the end.
Rather. Oh, OK, fine, yeah.
What was the impact of containerisation and mechanisation on your port? I mean, why did it impact so much on you?
Because the port as a whole, for many years, or going back to Roman times, was a labour-intensive activity. Thousands and thousands of staff and labour, you might imagine, to run it. But gradually, as you moved into the mechanised sphere and containerisation, it became a capital-intensive industry. Less men, but more equipment, which is very expensive equipment.
Now, what equipment were you bringing equipment in at the West India Docks, or were you still person based? I mean, manpower based.
Well, during the time that I was there as docks manager, that was a period of 6 years, from 1973 to 79. It was still virtually a labour intensive industry. We had mechanisation introduced and sophisticated container cranes, but only on a limited scale.
Was this a failure of investment by the Port of London Authority, or was it that they just couldn't compete with other ports when it came to establishing mechanisation?
No, in fact, we're the forerunners of mechanisation as far as ports were concerned. And in actual fact, that had been going on since the middle part of the 50s, slowly but surely. But one had to be realistic and realise that containerisation would eventually take over from general manual handling, and the container vessels were getting larger and larger. And it was this particular aspect that caused my particular group of docks to close, and subsequently the others.
So it was a navigational problem. They were just too big to get up the Thames and into the docks.
Into the dock, that was it. And if you use my dock as an example, I could accommodate vessels up to 585 feet long, and had been able to do so since 1802. But in the latter part of about 1978, I was informed and the PLA board that the next generation of vessels, of the customers that were using my dock, the shipping companies, would exceed 700 feet. Well, there's no way you can get a 700-foot ship in a 585-foot lock entrance. So a policy decision had to be taken to actually close the Indermill Dock.
And once again, I'll come back to that. Now, what were the other problems? You said, I mean, and this can reach far back into the time when you were going through your career. What problems were the docks facing, other than this? I mean, the mechanisation, you know, the thing. I mean, you said that people were having heart attacks, stress, the rest of it. Now, from what you said, part of this, at least, is the relationship with the dock labour and the unions.
Right.
Now, what were the problems, and whose fault was it? Was it the PLA, was it the unions, or was it intransigence on both sides?
What was
the nature of the problem with dock labour?
The PLA were, for want of a better expression, we were piggy in the middle between the organised dock labour and trade unions and the requirements of the shipping companies on the other side, who were there to get their vessel discharged and loaded as quickly as possible. Because when you come to think of it, in those days, a vessel, if it was delayed for one day, it would cost about £5,000. And then the idea was to get the vessel in and out as rapidly as possible.
Now, were the ship owners reasonable in their requirements for this to happen?
In the main, they were, but sometimes they were desperate. To give you a little example, if the vessel was going to leave our dock and were going to, say, for example, to Rotterdam, where they might have a dry docking program, and they were in a queue of vessels, they'd given a certain slot. If they couldn't get there that time, they would lose their slot, and it would be many days before they could get into the dry docking program. And at £5,000 a day, that's a lot of money they're going to use. That was the pressure they put on the PLA. Now, the other side of the coin was the dock labour. Now, bearing in mind, in those days, we worked under piecework conditions.
Now, can you explain, because it hardly exists, well, it does still exist, but I mean, can you explain the piecework system?
Well, the piecework system simply was that dock labour were paid for cargo handled largely on a tonnage, deadweight tonnage basis. Example, a bag tub of cargo, they might get paid a shilling a tonne in old currency. And they then handled cargo during the course of the working day, and according to the tonnage which they handled and the related rate, it would determine what their wages would be, either their basic wage or what they used to call surplus. That simply meant there was an excess that required, the money required in relation to their daily wage. And sometimes they earn considerably high wages as a result of that.
Now, did they then have a system of regular employment, or was it still a system where they'd turn up and queue up and be employed?
No, they were decasualised. The large majority were employed by the Dock Labour Board as casual labour, and then they were hired by either PLA or shipping companies to do the work according to what vessels were in dock at that particular time. But the PLA did have a permanent staff of labourers that they, in actual fact, obviously engaged purely on a weekly basis.
So I'm a bit confused. So were they casual labour or not? They weren't.
The vast majority of casual labour, other than the permanent labourers that the PLA, in actual fact, engaged.
Of them would not know that would be an instability for them.
Oh, yes. Quite uncertain what wages they were going to get on a daily basis. That's true.
That doesn't sound a particularly sensible way of organising labour. Was it forced on them? I mean, was it something that was essential due to the nature of
It was. You see, the nature of the port, if you can realise, with the coming and going of ships, some days you'd have no ships in dock, or very few. Other days you'd have a high number of ships in docks. So you could only engage labour as and when it was required. And then when the vessel was finished, then you would discharge the labour back to Dock Labour Board, and they in turn would be then used by another shipping company. It was a liquid type of arrangement as far as labour was concerned. And in the main, the dockers, especially those prepared to work hard, were quite happy to be engaged on a casual basis.
Now, what were then the problems, or the root of the problems with the it was the trade unions you had the problem with, wasn't it? Was it the dock labour force? Which was it?
No, you had the unofficial dock labour committees that tend to be what you might describe as recalcitrant labour. Mainly the idea was to foment a lot of trouble, because a number of them were related to the British Communist Party, and their job was to incite trouble in the dock. I think the name Jack Dash will be familiar to a lot of people.
Tell us about these unofficial. There were dock labour committees. Was Jack Dash the leader of one of
them? He was indeed.
So tell us about the operations of the committees and Jack Dash.
I don't really know too much about, other than the fact they organise themselves on an unofficial basis, used to meet outside the working hours, and then decided plans of action with regard to causing trouble in the docks.
And what? All right. So you don't know how they worked.
No,
I can understand that. You're the other.
I'm the manager. Yeah.
So, what effect did their operate? Did their
well? Periodically, they would cause trouble. They would cause strikes in the docks, either on a local basis or sometimes on a port basis, and it could be quite damaging. But
now these were unofficial strikes.
Absolutely, in the main, they were. Yeah.
And what sort of cause would they have? I mean, were they in any way? I mean, obviously your management, you're going to take the other side. But was there any legitimacy in your view in any of the things that they were arguing about?
Well, many things that they argued about could have been settled with sensible negotiation and compromise. And in the main, on a day-by-day basis, this is exactly what happened. The operational officer of the PLA, they negotiated with each gang on a daily basis as to what payments should be made. And generally, they were able to come to a compromise understanding. Some days you won, some days you lost. That was the spirit of it. But from a dock department or a whole dock angle, the sort of thing that caused problems, and certainly in latter years, was the unstuffing and stuffing of containers. And that gave rise to extensive port strikes in the latter years, and that simply meant claimed a cargo use expression stuff and unstuff, it meant literally loading and unloading containers at bases away from the docks, because they claimed the work was registered dock work. And to some extent, I could understand the reasoning behind it, because the work that would be normally done in the dock were then done by people outside the dock that weren't registered dock labour. Not labourers. I mean, I could see that point of view, but some of the petty problems, they were just nuisance value. But in the main...
What were the petty sort of things? I mean...
Well, asking for excess money for jobs which needed to be done. And a lot of the more level-headed dockers, they used to be offended by this action anyway, because it meant they lost wages over it during the course that they weren't working. Obviously, their piecework payments came to a stop, and they didn't like it either.
Now, what about this element of the communist? I mean, do you feel there was really a communist... sponsored subversion of the docks as part of a campaign against the United Kingdom? I mean, was it just they were troublemakers?
They were just troublemakers, I think. I don't know what policy they were adopting, because we weren't au fait with what went on with the British Communist Party.
So it was more, although they were communists, it was more just a troublemaking rather than an international communism.
That's right.
Communism,
that is absolutely right. Yeah,
Soviet
that's right.
Union.
That's right. That is correct, yeah.
And what about the official unions? What was your relationship like with them?
In the main, pretty good. They were fairly sensible, the union officers. They had a job to do, we had a job to do. But in the main, we were able to negotiate settlements on minor or major problems without too much difficulty.
And which union was it? Sorry.
There were two basic ones, the Transport and General Workers Union. It was referred to as the White Union. And the Stevedores and Dockers Union, that was called the Blue Union.
Why were they called... why were they called the different things?
For the simple reason, their union cards, one was white and one was blue.
And were these equally reasonable?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. You couldn't always come to agreement, but in the main we did, because the union officers realised they had a job to do, to get as good settlements for their members as possible, but they also had a responsibility to make sure the work went on and we didn't lose work as a result of the activities of the unofficial branch.
And how did the official unions get on with the unofficial dock labour committees?
I think at their throats wouldn't be a bad way of describing it. There was no love lost between them.
Did this lead in itself to disputes? Because you know that inter-union disputes can sometimes cause, or inter-labour disputes can cause trouble.
A lot of trouble, quite a great. But no, I don't remember any particular strike that could be related to those circumstances, no. Okay. Now, one aspect I think I'd like to cover, that is regard to the myth that dock labour helped to close the Port of London. I mean, that is a nonsense. Dock labour, recalcitrant dock labour, has a nuisance value, as with any heavy industry. And the port industry, as you realise, is a heavy industry. They did cause trouble. But the Jack Dash and Company, they in no way influenced the closure of the enclosed docks in London. It was, as I said a little while ago, the change in technology that is what caused the actual upper docks to close, because the cargo had eventually to go down river, which is now to what is now known as the Port of Tilbury, where most of the cargo is handled at Tilbury that was handled in the upper docks in previous years.
So the level of trouble that you'd faced from the unions, although it's liable to give you a heart attack or stress, was not sufficient on its own to close the port.
Not at all.
You could have carried on working.
Absolutely.
If technology had remained the same, it would still be open.
Absolutely. It was just a cut and thrust of daily negotiation, but that's what you're paid for, and the work would continue.
Now, what about people often wonder about stealing and the problems of dock labour or anyone else stealing from them. Were the ports, in fact, that's one of the reasons they'd originally been made, you said. Was there a problem with theft or widespread theft from the ports or from your port in particular?
Well, there was. It wasn't widespread theft. you had petty pilfering, probably on a fair scale. Large-scale plundering, it just didn't happen like it was when vessels were handled on the river.
So what do you mean by petty? How small is petty?
Well, for example, if someone broke open a case of apples and stole an apple or a tin of pineapple, something silly like that. If they did that, they would probably consume it on the premises, but if they tried to take it at the dock gate, you have to remember the PLA had an independent police force. Both uniformed and plain clothes, and many dock workers, indeed staff, labour, lightermen, people that worked in dock, they were apprehended by the PLA police and were duly prosecuted. Yes.
This was another low grade problem, really.
It was, yes, just a nuisance failure.
Now, what about the docks were old. Mm. And that's part of the problem with the size of them. But were there other problems caused by the age of the port and the fixtures and fittings and the dock gates and just the things that made the port up what it was?
Well, no, not really, because while basically the infrastructure was the same since the early part of the 1800s, it was progressively updated. You get lock entrance gates. Changed, you'd get cargo cranes completely changed, all sorts of equipment. It evolved over the years into much higher standard of equipment that you had. But with regard to the docks itself, the docks walls were intact. The enclosed water was impounded by proper impounding pumps, drawing the water from the river. And to my mind, if it hadn't been changed in technology, it could have gone on indefinitely.
So the PLA had carried out its responsibilities in the sense of maintaining and keeping the port up to a reasonably modern standard.
It was
only the huge size of the new ships that would eventually scupper.
Exactly, that was it. Now, it's incumbent upon the PLA to make sure the facilities were updated progressively, and that was enshrined in the PLA Act of 1909 when it became a statutory body and they took over the full responsibility of running the port.
Now, did you have a military role at all in the event of war, in the sense of it was such a big, huge British facility, you know, was there a military side or a defence side that you were aware of? I mean, you were running, I'm looking at the picture now, it's a huge area, as you said, of central London. Was there any scheme of defence or anything that you had to operate?
Well, during the Cold War, preparations had to be made, obviously, by the governments of changed circumstances. And being in Ireland, the ports obviously played a very big part. And we had arrangements under what we call the shadow wartime scheme, whereby the facilities in London, particularly mechanised equipment, a lot of other equipment, actually there were plans to immediately take them and distribute them to the smaller south coast ports. And I was part of this shadow committee. It was obviously highly confidential, and I was sworn under the Official Secrets Act in no way to discuss this with people. And this went on, in actual fact, to the day I retired from the PLA, when I was released from that obligation.
Did you deal with naval vessels at all?
Well, only that we were able to give them berthing accommodation as and when it was required in London. But we didn't provide any services or victualling or any service which the Navy required, because they did it themselves. All we offered them was berthing facilities.
And would this be taken up very often? I mean,
periodically. Even had submarines in there sometimes. Yeah.
Now, how was the actual closure managed? Was it closed while you were there?
Well, no. The India dock closed a few months after I retired, because I was given the opportunity in the latter part of 1978 to take early requirement if I chose to, because it was realised that the docks were progressively closing as I went downriver, and I was of an age, I was 53 at the time, that I was literally the oldest docks manager. And I could, because of the pension arrangements, I could actually go on to pension, but some of the others hadn't quite reached that age group, and they therefore didn't have, the PLA didn't have an alternative appointment which they could offer me. So they said, would you care to take early retirement? Now, after 32 years, with a rough and tumble of dock life, I felt that I'd done my stint, and the opportunity of retiring early had a certain attraction, as you might imagine.
Now, just to pick up, you then went into a very long career with the Citizens Advice Bureau, which went on from 1979 to 1999, which is outside the brief of the War Museum. But there are two things we haven't covered yet. One I want to cover is that you were a weekend pilot with the Volunteer Reserve at RAF Hornchurch and qualified as a flying instructor between 1947 and 1953. Can you talk to us a bit about this period? Was this your territorial, in a sense?
It was. Like being a Territorial Army, actually, RAF Volunteer Reserve, yes. I decided when a Volunteer Reserve unit was developed at RAF Hornchurch that I would like to continue weekend flying, and especially that I didn't have to pay for it. They were paying me, which is a much better arrangement, and in company with quite a lot of wartime pilots, we then joined and began to fly Tiger Moths for a limited time. It was pleasurable, and then they were changed or removed and eventually replaced by the new aircraft called a Chipmunk. It's a Canadian-built aircraft.
Now, what was the point of this flying? I mean, were you just flying to keep your eye in, basically?
Yeah, keep your eye in and practice, because in the event of war, you could have been called up, and obviously then had to resume normal flying duties.
And what about how did you find going back to flying after we'd started, wasn't it?
Tiger? Absolutely, yeah.
What were Tiger Moths and Chipmunks like to fly?
Well, they were like toys, really. Quite easy to fly, but very pleasurable.
What about the Chipmunk? How did it compare with the Tiger? It was the replacement.
That's right.
Was it better, worse, or...? Well,
it wasn't a biplane. It was a monoplane for a start. You also had a canopy over the cockpit, as against the Tiger Moth, it was helmet and goggles, etc. But it was a very pleasurable aircraft. And one thing, you had what we call Kaufman starters. You could automatically start it electrically and with a cartridge. As against the Tiger Moth, we had to swing the prop to get the aeroplane going. But a very pleasurable aeroplane to fly.
Is it faster?
Oh, it was a lot faster, yes, yeah, than the Tiger Moth.
And the Tiger Moths were actually phased out, were they?
They were being paid at that stage. Were being phased out by the RAF, yeah. And they were had full instrument panels, far more than the Tiger Moth. And we used to do instrument flying, formation flying, SBA, which is a standard beam approach, but we did that largely at Biggin Hill. We had to go over there where they had the facilities to do SBA training, yeah.